Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday. It is the 10th of November, and it's very nice to have you with us. Aaron and I were just talking. It's a little cold, chilly today. It's a cold snap, I guess is what they're calling it.
Yeah.
A cold snap. So, you know, a little snow on the ground.
I hope so.
Yes.
Yeah. No. No. You saw it. Yeah. That we saw. Did you see it on the way coming down?
No.
From Cambridge. Really?
Oh, a lot of frost, but no snow.
Oh yeah. Some good snow. Even here in Albany, actually. Well, good morning. Welcome, and very nice to have you with us. Let me introduce the panel to you. We have a great one, and we'll get started on all of the news of the day. I'll begin from the left of your radio and move to the right, only geographically speaking. Teresa Bourgeois is with us. She is a communications consultant and is here. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here. This is the definition of a blustery day.
It is a blustery day. Winnie the Pooh and the blustery day.
There we go.
Aaron Pasidi is with us. He is a professor. He is a professor of business and economics at Siena College in Loudonville, New York. He joins us every Friday, and we're thrilled to have him. Thank you very much, Aaron. Good
Thank
to have you,
Joe.
Here. Judith Enck is a former regional administrator with the Environmental Protection Agency, better known as the EPA, and she is here with us on Fridays as well. And we welcome Judith. Good morning.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. Alan Shartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. You have your Alan mug. I just noticed that your mug has your name on it.
Well, our wonderful Colleen did it, and she did it in her excellent
penmanship.
And then she put, when it's microwavable, she put plastic over it.
Oh, it's like calligraphy.
And I am very concerned about all my friends because I've been looking at this article that I have in front of me. It was in the Times and the Daily.
Oh, you made copies for everyone, aren't you, sweet? Yeah, okay.
That's what I did. I said, from the New York POST, says, light daily amounts, hike risk docs. I drink, one drink. One drink link to cancer. And so what it says is that, that while we know, we've all been told to have a red wine every day, and that's good for our hearts, that now it looks like, you know, people who imbibe even moderately put themselves at more of a risk for cancer, to which everybody says, I don't believe a word of it.
Yeah, it sounds like BS to me.
And it may be...
Sorry,
I wonder
say
why.
It.
Maybe it is... one of those stories that you see on one day and then you never see it again. So I once saw a story in the New York Times, my favorite, which was rhesus monkeys, which had vasectomies, had larger amounts of heart attacks. And I never saw it again. I never saw a reference to that again. So studies come and go, you know, that's the way they are.
And they can be disproven, too. I mean, this is just an initial one. And,
right.
That's right. We'll see what else is out there.
But seeing this makes
Ray
me
Graff is,
need it. I think
Graff
I want to drink.
Is looking in the studio and shaking his head.
All right. We are, let's get off on the right foot here. We'll talk about the issues of
Too
the day.
Late.
Besides the ever important have a drink a day story, we'll get onto other stuff. Let's talk about Roy Moore here. This story is going on in as a Senate race happens, and a woman has come forward saying that Roy Moore initiated a sexual encounter when she was 14. He was 32. Of course, this happens in Alabama as Roy Moore is in a Senate race, and it is. I don't know. It would certainly seem unlikely for the Democrat to win, although the Democrat opponent, Doug Jones, was certainly doing well in the polls. But still, it is a Republican state. And so Roy Moore has these charges leveled against him. And the Washington Post, published the story Thursday afternoon. At that point, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a handful of other GOP senators, even the president said that Roy Moore must step aside
if
the account is true. So the question is, well, how do you prove the account before the election, which is in, what, a month?
December 12th.
So a month and 2 days. And how do you prove it in that period of time? In many of the cases that we have seen where people have said that they're, you know, have at least acknowledged they were in the same room at the same time, Roy Moore is definitely digging in his heels and saying, I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. So, okay, go ahead.
He's following the Trump playbook.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Remember the Access Hollywood tapes, and that's what Trump did.
But I have a question for the panel that maybe am I stepping into your
I just want to say what the charge is here. So Lee Korfman says she was 14 years old when an older man approached her outside of a courtroom in Alabama. She was sitting on a wooden bench with her mother. They both recall when the man introduced himself as Roy Moore. It was early 1979, and Moore, now the Republican nominee in Alabama for a U.S. Senate seat, was a 32-year-old assistant DA. He struck up a conversation. Korfman and her mother say, and offered to watch the girl while her mother went inside for a child custody hearing. He said, don't you want her to go in there and hear all that? I'll stay out here with her. And the mother said she thought that was very nice. And then Moore chatted with the girl, asked her for her phone number. Days later, she says he picked her up at the corner of her house. Told her how pretty she was, kissed her. On a second visit, she says he took off her shirt, pants, removed his clothes, and he touched her over her bra and underpants and guided her hand to touch him over his underwear. The girl obviously wanted out, and there are a whole bunch of different friends who confirmed that this encounter took place at the time.
Well, no, that she said it. Okay, right.
Well, they are saying that her childhood friends say that this is in keeping with the story that she told at the time. And then three other women interviewed by the Washington Post in recent weeks say Moore pursued them when they were between the ages of 16 and 18, and he was in his early 30s. Okay, so
the state auditor comes out in wild defense of this guy. And what does he say? He says Jesus was an adult and Mary was a child. And so it's the same thing. That's what the state auditor says. Boy, they had a search for him and comes out and says it. And I'm wondering, and this is the question I wanted to ask the panel, is because I'm Jewish, and I understand the whole idea of Christianity. I understand the whole idea of evangelical folks, but how do you support somebody with that morality who does something like this?
I think it's called hypocrisy.
Yeah, and let's remember, Roy Moore is the guy who got kicked off the bench
twice.
Twice. First, because he wouldn't remove the 5,000-pound Ten Commandment monument on his courthouse, and secondly, because he would not support the ruling on same-sex marriage. So he was removed from the bench twice on two pretty important issues. And I don't think anyone can defend this, but some Alabama Republican leaders are. It's interesting to see members of Congress squirm on this. And, you know, the sad reality is the woman who confirmed this account was 14 years old at the time. Other teenagers came. None of them know each other. None of them were looking to be interviewed by the Washington Post. The Post had to really track them down. And there is a consistent pattern here. Roy Moore, of course, did what Donald Trump did after the Access Hollywood tapes came out and completely denied it. But what's interesting to me, because, okay, yes, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. What's interesting to me in these situations is if you are being charged in the court of public opinion with this, what you really need to do is not tweet, but go and hold a news conference and say, this is, you know, what really happened, and I will sit here for as long as it takes and answer every question that's posed to me.
Defend yourself.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he's not doing that.
By the way, I've said it before, I'll say it again. The only person who seems to rise to any of these occasions is John McCain, who came out first and forcefully and said he should immediately step aside, no questions about it.
Absolutely, but there is an issue about stepping aside, because even if he steps down, his name remains on the ballot. they haven't figured out any mechanism because they've passed the date in which his name can be removed from the ballot.
But Teresa, can't there be a write-in?
That's
what Lisa Murkowski did.
Luther Strange, for instance, mm-hmm. who lost to Moore in the September primary, the Republicans could rally around him and write him in. I want to really make a wacky suggestion in that maybe we'll see the former Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions throw his hat in the ring if he wants to return to the Senate.
You are not the first one to make that suggestion, by the way.
Or they could elect Doug Jones.
Yeah, well, I think we're hearing these really disturbing defenses, the Mary and Joseph routine, which is really offensive.
Besides being offensive, just isn't even biblically correct. Right. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Well, right. Joseph, I'm not even going to. Let's not talk about
that. I want to hear this.
I'll go to that one from an expert, a Jesuit, Father James Martin, who is the editor of America Magazine, which is the Catholic. He tweets, for the biblically challenged, number one, despite artistic representations, we have no idea about the exact ages of either the Virgin Mary or St. Joseph at the time of their betrothal or marriage. Number two, comparing the allegations against Roy Moore in any way to Joseph and Mary is disgusting.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
Case closed.
I agree.
That's what the expert says.
But you were making a broader point, Judith.
Yeah, I was making the point that Doug Jones is a viable candidate, and I think there are a lot of women voters in Alabama who will be quite troubled by these allegations, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. It's hard to be a mom, a grandmother, a father, a grandfather, and just kind of brush this aside. It's one thing if you're a political operative who wants to defend the race, but this is different.
And yet, if you're playing, as you say, if he's playing by the Trump playbook, the Access Hollywood tape, that did not keep that man from being president of the United States, and women voted for him as a result. Mm-hmm. So, and now you have a smaller petri dish of the state of Alabama, which tends, obviously, is a very, very red state. So do you think it will have more of an effect?
I think there's a good chance that Roy Moore will win this election. He will be seated. More facts will tumble out, and then the Senate has to decide. They could expel him if two-thirds of the senators vote to do that. That's going to be gut check time, and this is not a one-day story. This is going to go on and on. I think it's part of a pattern. We'll probably see other young women come forward, and I think there needs to be a criminal investigation because who knows when this behavior ceased. There are statute of limitations for these allegations from 30 years ago, but who knows? I mean, he may still be doing this.
And let's not forget that they were all minors, too, at the time.
No, this is a pedophilia.
This is more egregious than straight sexual harassment. This is.
Yet, shockingly, the Breitbart editor gets on TV in an interview and said, well, let's realize it's just one woman, not three, because the others were all of consenting age, which a 16-year-old, for goodness sake.
But he plied them with alcohol. They were all below the legal age of 19. I mean, my sense is this is the tip of the iceberg with this guy.
The same thing with the Weinstein story, the Kevin Spacey story, all of these stories of sexual harassment that, you know, once the dam opens, then the water starts flowing, and this is obviously the first in that sequence.
This is also very much a political story, and a seat in the Senate is up for grabs here as well.
Pretty important.
Well, that's the thing, because with the tax vote, it's such, and you have Rand Paul now out.
And Menendez, Teresa, they have to start all over again in the Menendez trial, and it looks from the jury leaks he's going to get off.
Yeah, it does.
Because one less Democrat would be very harmful to Democrats.
Yeah. Rand Paul, I want to hear more about Compostgate. this can't really be a story about the doctor next door neighbor didn't like the compost and the pumpkin growing. There's got to more to that.
His neighbor said that it's a dispute that's been going on for years, and it just exploded in that one moment.
People can be pretty crazy on that stuff. I know, because I know of a story in which a lovely young couple moved into a house in Alford, Massachusetts. Not us. In Alford, Massachusetts. And then they cut down, innocently, a tiny little sapling between themselves and the guy who owned 200 acres next to them. Well, the son of the guy, a psychiatrist, by the way, decided that he had been mortally offended, and he ordered up 2 truckloads full of chicken poop, which he put on the lawn, which is right next to the dividing line, right next to the house. Now, that is a little crazy, isn't it?
It certainly is. I just want to go on the record that this should not discourage anyone from composting.
Right.
Or
well,
using
yes.
Good point.
That's exactly.
An important part of our solid waste management hierarchy.
But Roy Moore.
I do want to get back to Roy Moore, and we're going to take a break here in a second. But we do have. I do want to talk about the Rand Paul story too, because that just gets weirder and weirder. That's a strange story as well. Let's take a break. We'll pause here. We'll come back. We have letters. We have more conversation. We have lots of topics. We have great panelists. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable, listening to the music of Lydia Lovelace, who will be playing at Helsinki Hudson tonight. You can find out more at HelsinkiHudson.com, HelsinkiHudson.com. So we've been talking about the Roy Moore story and the charges against him. One of the other things that I look at in this particular case of what we were talking about this during the break of what happens next, the defense that I have heard, the defense this morning, even by many Republicans, who, yes, were unanimous, not really unanimous, but were at least somewhat unified in their, you know, he should resign if these allegations are true. But by the same token, didn't really say anything. I'm just interested in what the overall plan is if this all blows up in the next 2, 3, 4 days. I think Aaron was the one who said, you know, this could just be the tip of the iceberg, and all of a sudden this goes down. Then what does this do to the not only what happens in Alabama, but in the Republican Party as a whole, of these people who have sort of quasi-supported it?
Well, they more than quasi-supported it. A lot of people actively supported him. I mean, Mike Pence, the day after the election,
I mean, since these charges. There's still people who just haven't said anything, and that's
right.
Those
but
are
the
people.
But the local, the Alabama people seem to be coming to his defense, and he put out a fundraising letter last night to try to raise money to support this terrible attack on him. But again, let's remember, Roy Moore. What did he say about Sandy Hook? You know, he talked about how that this was a response to an evil, you know, that they had done. Same thing with 9/11. Let's see, he says because Americans, quote, have forgotten the law of God. That's why all those kids were killed at Sandy Hook. Same thing about 9/11. Congressman Keith Ellison, who was duly elected, happens to be a Muslim, and he has repeatedly said because he's a Muslim, he should not be allowed to be seated in Congress. So there's beyond this atrocious, horrific pedophilia charge, there's a lot of other reasons why one should not be for Roy Moore, yet they've stood by him until now.
I want to make one point, and that is that many of the so-called heroes in the United States Senate, Republicans, who are supporting getting him out of there, were the very people who really didn't like his candidacy in the first place and said so during that time. And I'm sure somebody's going to say that now.
Well, Mitch McConnell had a former staffer quoted yesterday saying, "This is what happens when Steve Bannon recruits candidates who have no right to be running
for public office." I was
going to
ask you
office.
About that, of
yeah.
this, because there is now a lot of spotlight on Steve Bannon and the work that he is doing in enlisting these candidates to run. And, of course, the back and forth between the president and Steve Bannon over during the primary of Luther Strange and Roy Moore. And, of course, the president endorsed Strange. Steve Bannon
endorsed. In a strange
endorsed,
way, though.
Yes. Well, much like he did in Virginia, right? He endorsed. There was a full-throated endorsement. This is great. This is great. And then when he lost, who's he? Wait, what? He was...
Right.
I don't know
he
him.
Didn't embrace
you know, there was another story in, I believe, the Times yesterday, which was fascinating, about how Trump is pushing all of his judicial candidates for the lower
Quickly.
Courts, and the bar associations are, in some of these cases, holding them eminently unqualified,
right.
And it doesn't stop them a bit.
Well, I think McConnell knows something is the other shoe, the other, the shoe's going to drop, like, on the centipede. A lot of shoes are going to drop in November, December, and I think McConnell is trying to rush things. I'm not sure he's got, you know, votes to get not just taxes, but confirmations. You know, the other thing is, I think tomorrow, this is just too in the weeds, but you can be in an acting leadership position in federal agencies, but you can only serve for 300 days. And most of the federal agencies, most of the appointees are acting. They're actually...
So the clock is up.
So the clock is up. And so a lot of those people have to leave those seats. And the agencies are so dysfunctional today. Virtually every agency, whether it's FEMA or HHS, you know, that story with the woman who was the acting head of Homeland Security stepping down because she wouldn't listen to the White House Chief of Staff's political directive. The agencies, and I speak to friends in various federal agencies, the agencies are a mess. And they're going to go off the rails even more with these acting people having to step aside.
And you can add the Federal Reserve to that list as well, because the Board of Governors, which is a seven-seat organization with Jerome Powell replacing Yellen. It's not clear whether Yellen is going to remain on the Board of Governors or resign. William Dudley from the New York Fed announced his resignation. Trump has a chance to totally reshape the Federal Reserve Board, and he's made no movement to do so.
He's slow on the appointments, which I actually think is good. Yeah. I don't want more Trump appointees in there.
Well, in the case of the economic stuff, Aaron, don't you think it's because things have been going relatively well and he doesn't want to screw it up?
Sure.
You know, so that he doesn't want to put in a bunch of people who you don't think it's going well? Therese, I see you shaking your head.
I don't think in some cases, I don't think that they're filling these jobs either because they can't get people to go in and or because they just are not competent to fill the jobs.
I think it's rank incompetence.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that it's that what's happening here is the Obama effect and the Bush effect, to be fair. I mean, the line is still going up. And he doesn't want to do anything by appointing some, is the right word, antediluvian or whatever, people who are going to mess it up with some misplaced guidance.
Then he should appoint people to the Fed who are going to support the policies that have been working over the past decade.
Easy for you to say. But you see, if you do that, you're admitting that your predecessors were actually on the right track.
Well, I'm happy he places his vanity over the health of the U.S. economy.
Well, very easy for you to say, Aaron, but nevertheless, that's just the way this guy is.
I understand that, and that's the tragedy of all of this.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and you're right.
Let's go to letters.
Oh, letters. Here we go. Larry says, "Alan, what is odd is the controller of Alabama, a fine Christian gentleman, doesn't understand the concept of the Immaculate Conception. Yes, Mary was a young girl, but remained a virgin." And by the way, I think I messed up earlier today when I said Jesus and Mary. I meant Joseph and Mary, obviously.
Yeah.
Shows you what I know. Michael
There's
said,
a lot more odd than that in this story.
Michael says, "Roy Moore and Rachel Maddow. Maddow had an Alabama journalist on her show last night. His take, Moore will be a slam dunk winner in next month's election. Reason, Alabamans see this as Northeastern fake news. And that's Michael from Castleton. I was watching her a little bit. Boy, she's pretty dramatic. Okay, and Moore, as Marty says, okay. Happy early winter, panel. McConnell added the if true caveat, knowing that there very likely won't be any further proof. The account of the woman, though, seems highly credible and believable. The GOP would rather have a Republican pedophile elected than a Democrat. Recent polls, however, show a close race. Recent Fox News polls actually show a dead heat. Doug Jones, in capital letters, can win.
See, that's think he's very, very impressive. Mm-hmm.
He's an impressive candidate.
He's really impressive
Deputy
candidate.
U.S. attorney, was he?
And he's the one that the Birmingham children's bombing case, Ku Klux Klan. He prosecuted that case, and he, you know, steel worker from there, went to law school. It's just done a lot of good.
And
in
no
the state.
Accusations of pedophilia against him.
You know what? I keep thinking about Donald Trump and the beauty pageant stories.
Yes.
And the Teen USA story.
Yeah.
I just, you know, of him going into the
dressing room
with those teen, you know, these young girls. Four of them came forward and said, you know, they weren't dressed. He walked in. They were horrified. Yet he gets elected.
But
I mean, is this?
It's almost as if it's,
I mean,
forgotten.
This is worse than that. But what is going on in our country that we're not just absolutely horrified by that behavior and by this accusation of pedophilia?
But do you think time moves quick, right? So it seems as though there is now, and I'm saying this in reference to the Louis C.K. story, mm-hmm. the comedian who was the subject of a major article in the New York Times of many women claiming very lewd sexual acts in front of them, and it's a very disturbing story. That story had been around for a long time,
a long time,
years. And
stories had been written about it.
Major stories had been done about it. I mean, everybody, you know, it was Roseanne Barr came out about this years ago and said, okay, while you're picking on Bill Cosby, oh, by the way, there's this guy who is the top guy in comedy who is doing this every day.
And he joked about it.
Yes, I was going to say, like Cosby, who talked about drugging women and doing that? He did. He said
it was part of his
stuff.
Well, in the movie, in the this recent movie also makes dramatizes it for want of a better term. So the question I have is: there seems to be this pre-Weinstein, post-Weinstein situation where all of these cases. So you wonder if even if the Trump thing. Came out now as opposed to then, if it would be much different.
This is the Weinstein effect, and hopefully the Weinstein effect will be in operation for years to come.
Yeah, but Judith, will it turn around and bite the president in the behind? In other words, is it capable of having enough energy to turn around and get after him?
Well, the women who made accusations against President Trump have now said that they're upset that he was not held accountable the way Harvey Weinstein was.
And they're banding together.
They're coming together with one lawyer, and who knows? I mean, I think a lot of Americans kind of forget about the Access Hollywood tape until you are reminded about it.
But the Access Hollywood tape, I don't want to downplay it by any stretch of the imagination, but that was one in a series of very disturbing. I mean, as you were mentioning, Teresa.
The
I mean, there
USA
were
USA thing was disgusting.
There were so many things that he had said, so many accusations, and so many things that he bragged about on radio shows and in interviews and so forth, that would have indicated improper behavior.
We have a sexual harasser and possibly a sexual predator as president of the United States.
And I think that I might be wrong about this, but I think one of the reasons that the Harvey Weinstein situation has resonated so much is because there was so much underlying rage, anger, distress because somebody like Donald Trump, who treats women the way he does and brags about it, was able to be elected. And
it's offensive. There was a great town hall special on CNN last
Allison
night.
Allison Camerata, yeah. Amazing.
Really, really well done.
Gretchen Carlson.
Anita Hill kicked it off.
Yeah.
Senator Gillibrand, our own Senator Gillibrand, was brilliant on this issue. She, of course, has been confronting this issue in the military, one of the hardest cultures to address this. And they also had a woman, Tarana Burke, from Brooklyn, who started the Me Too hashtag. I did not realize that that was started 10 years ago.
Right.
And she started it because she worked with a lot of young women who needed to tell their stories. They were survivors, and they were going through life with pits in their stomach, just reliving their experiences. And she started this campaign to let them speak their truth and find support from other young women who've gone through these experiences.
And I found it very interesting that one of the things that McConnell and the others are saying, and in the House and the Senate, now the Senate and the House in this case, is that there's going to be compulsory sexual training,
anti-harassment training.
And that it's going to be they're going to have to go, the senators and the reps, but so are the interns
and the staff, yeah,
to sort of know and to know their rights, because the interns are just like deer walking around in the headlights.
And isn't it amazing that the Senate passed a bill just yesterday requiring this, and that our Congress did not have anti-harassment mandatory training?
Actually, they had a policy, and the policy was disgraceful, as Joe,
the 3 months
talking about this, because I saw Senator Gillibrand's remarks in which they had to, for 3 months they had to get counseling or something?
If you were making a claim of harassment, you had to have 30 days of counseling, then 30 days of mediation with the person who you made the charge against, and then a 30-day cooling-off period.
And then, and this is what's really disgraceful, on top of all of that, there would be a payout to the person who was the victim.
With tax dollars.
Right, with tax dollars. But we're not allowed to know what that payout was and how many there are.
Right, and Senator Gillibrand has a bill to address that. Yeah. But that's an astonishing situation.
A bipartisan bill, by the way.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to more letters and finish up this conversation, move on to other issues. We welcome your comments. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. sometimes you have to watch for the light. Good morning. Welcome back. Alan Chartok is here. Judith Hank, Aaron Pasitti, and Teresa Bourgeois. Just because you're not listening doesn't mean we're not still doing a show.
Yeah. We just keep talking.
We're still doing a show.
Joe, I did want to mention one more time, there are just a few of those Harry Belafonte tickets. Whoops. That are available at theegg.org. And you can, we hope
for
to
what
see,
night, Alan?
For, tomorrow
thank
night.
You, Teresa. Saturday night at the Egg. And once you find your way in that place, you can have a great time.
A good way to spend Veterans Day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yes, certainly honoring our veterans this this weekend. Tomorrow is Veterans Day, and wonderful, beautiful celebrations being planned across our region. So keep that in mind as well. We're going to do a couple letters, and then we're going to move on to some other issues.
Okay. Susan says about Roy Moore, "Hello, panelists. Thanks for another interesting day of discussion. Re Moore. Maybe somebody should put a large monument on his front lawn that says, 'Thou shalt not molest young girls and women.'"
Here,
Susan
here.
And Redmond.
Yeah. Thank you, Susan.
Make it
and
three
then
tons
go
instead of
Doug
two.
Jones.
What'd you say, Teresa?
And then go support Doug Jones. I'm harping on that.
Okay,
he's a great guy. Go support him.
So Jill says, "Good morning, panel."
Good morning, Jill. Mm-hmm.
"There were women who voted for Trump even after his sexual misconduct admission. What makes anyone think they won't vote for Moore after more misconduct allegations?" Well, let me just answer that if I can start it, and then I know that everybody else will have something to say. In elections, you don't need everybody. You just need 5% or 6%, and that's considered a blowout in most elections. So you don't have to change 100% of women's minds if you change 6%, and I'm willing to bet 6% of those women can identify with what's happening here.
And also, what we saw in Virginia is the people who had not voted came out and voted.
Right.
So the standard, conservatives came out and voted, but the did not vote party voted.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It made a tremendous difference. It made a tremendous difference at the top of the ticket, and it made a tremendous difference in the mayor's races, the very local races. So if folks who have not voted, who are appalled by allegations of pedophilia, decide to vote, then Doug Jones can.
Well, you know what we love about you the most, Teresa, of all the wonderful things you do here, is that you really do think about these things. So I'm going to give you a provocative question. Do you think the people of Alabama are the same as the people of Virginia? Now, remember, Virginia's next to Washington. They have this incredible middle class. We have a lot of people. But Alabama's a little different.
Well, I haven't looked at the numbers in Alabama, but I do know that they have a I would hope that there are enough voters who are disgusted by pedophilia that I think that's a common, that can be a common thing we can all agree is a bad thing.
Enough voters who have daughters and wives, by
enough,
the way.
Right. There you go.
And sons.
Yes, it's, and sons. Yeah.
Not just restricted. But also, I think this race will be the only thing on the ballot. This is a special election.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And this is not a primary. This is, everyone gets to vote.
Yeah, yeah. So, this is not only Republicans.
I think there's a good chance Roy Moore will win unless there's a really, really strong write-in campaign for another Republican and they can split the vote.
Yeah, but, in a post-truth world, people can just say, yeah, that's not true. I'm going to choose not to believe that.
And then they'll rally his
and then they base. Right, exactly. And
The pedophilia pack.
But
dominate.
But if enough women in Alabama come out who have, strong social ties to the area, that might be enough to tilt the scales. So it really depends on how deep this ran and how widespread it was.
And don't forget the number of women and some men who reside in Alabama are very likely the victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault. It's a very high percentage. There's a recent Harvard education study on the number of women between ages 18 to 25 who've been sexually harassed. It's over 85%.
Is that right?
Yeah. So that will that will definitely, I think, be on voters' minds.
Well, you make a point. I have another feeling about this, but this is unprovable. And that is the establishment, in quotes, has decided Moore is unacceptable. And one way or another, that guy's going down. It may be in an election when this stuff comes out. It may be on the Senate floor when he gets there. But he is unacceptable in terms of their vision of themselves, their self-image and everything else. And they're going to get him.
And that's why I think John McCain spoke out so forcefully. He really is committed to the institution of the Senate and the Congress. And he is probably appalled that someone who these charges are suggested would be seated as a U.S. senator.
So, yes, but on the other hand, John McCain may be dying. We don't want to say he's dying, but he may be.
He has a
brain tumor. And that gives somebody a different perspective than somebody who wants to win the next Republican primary and is afraid of that.
Right. So remember, if Moore wins, I think they'll seat him. Whoever wins will be seated rapidly. The election is December 12th, and it's going to be right in the middle of when they need their vote on
taxes,
on corporate tax reduction.
And that's why
I think that the Republican Party is not going to push too hard to remove him.
Right.
I think that they have to say enough to be credible, but not so much that he doesn't win. But also, Doug Jones, remember, he used to work for Howell Heflin, the great Judge Heflin, who was a, he was a Democrat that won in Alabama. It was a while back, but
I remember him.
He was tremendous. And so
Democrats are endangered species in Alabama,
but
they
can
sometimes
win.
They can pull it off.
The right ones can win.
Catherine says, men harassers. It seems in every case the accused flatly denies the allegation. So far, Trump has led the way on this. Clearly, power is more important than the truth, and they all seem to think they will get away with this despite what has happened with Weinstein and others. It's painful to think there is not an apology, a scintilla of understanding extended to victims whose whole lives have been affected.
Yeah.
All right. Meredith says, Roy Moore was removed from the bench for ignoring the power of the federal judiciary twice. He has no respect for separation of powers or the structure of our constitutional democracy. He will be a danger to our country. Doug Jones is a respected U.S. attorney who successfully prosecuted KKK members who killed four young African-American girls. He would be an asset to Congress, and that's from Meredith.
Yeah, look at his bio. He's very impressive. I tweeted out his bio yesterday. He's really impressive.
Well, I think all of us could agree he's very impressive. The question is, what will the average Alabamian think, you know, of him?
We have to go to a break. So how many letters do we have left?
Two more.
Okay, let's go.
Okay. Jacobs says, as far as taxes for middle-class Americans, Republican thoughts and prayers will be with us. That's all.
All right.
And Christina says, just an FYI, the Immaculate Conception refers to the conception of Mary and is related to original sin. Virgin birth refers to the conception of Jesus. Either way, let's keep the Holy Family out of this mess. Christina.
Yes.
Yeah. Amen.
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 Amen. Amen. Amen.
Yes. And on that, we'll go to a break. We'll be back. We'll go back and Ray will have news, and we'll come back. We'll talk about Puerto Rico. We'll talk.
Oh, taxes.
Thank you. Well, and we'll talk tax plans as well. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's Friday, everybody.
Yay!
Yay!
Semper Fi, by the way. Happy birthday to the Marine Corps, too.
Oh,
Semper Fi, Semper Fi.
My brother will be happy. Former Marine. And
I don't think he can be a former Marine, Joe. I think
that's right. He's not an active Marine. Yes.
The reason I said that is because I knew we were going to get.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Now let me for my brother too. Probably I'll get a call.
Thank you for his service.
Yes. Let me ask this question. Don't forget Friday night. Saturday night. Harry Belafonte at the Egg. It's at 7:30 and. You want to be there. Alan's going to be interviewing this icon.
Yep.
And if by the way, if icon doesn't fit him, I don't know who it does. It's really quite incredible. Amazing. So theegg.org to find out more information. Let's go to other stories. We have a lot here, and I want to get to it all. We'll talk. Aaron, I'll put you on the spot because you got to talk about the House plan, tax plan last week. So... the son of that is the Senate tax plan, which diverges from the House version. Tell us a little bit about what you make of what we're seeing coming out of the Senate.
It seems like the House and the Senate are a little schizophrenic here. This was really surprising to see. I thought there would be a lot of coalescence around the business tax cuts. And the Senate is proposing a one-year delay in lowering the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. So as Judith and I were talking about in the green room before, that this should not be labeled the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It should be labeled the Business Tax Cuts and Dividend Payouts to Wealthy Individuals Act, because of the $1.5 trillion over the next decade, a trillion of that goes to business tax cuts, leaving only about $500 billion for personal tax cuts. So, the one-year delay in lowering the corporate tax rate, which is clearly going to infuriate the White House and probably the House, but they're going to keep they're going to try to reinstate the mortgage interest tax deduction, the medical expense deduction. They're going to totally eliminate the state and local tax deduction. They're going to increase the number of brackets to 7 from Trump's proposed number of 4. They're lowering the top marginal tax rate on high-income individuals. They're eliminating the pass-through that allows small business owners to be taxed at individual rates instead of corporate rates. They're just adding a whole lot of mess and really muddying the waters here, which... I don't know what the end objective is. I was thinking last night and this morning on the way here, what's the political play? Why is the Senate trying to do this? What are they trying to get out of this? And I can't figure it out.
So if you're a conspiratorialist, what you're thinking, and we'll go to Teresa on this one because as a former Senate staffer, she understands it all too well, which is the conference committee. When they bring this thing to conference, a lot of the things that are appalling to so many of us are going to disappear and they're going to have what they wanted. The conference can come up with anything that it wants. Right, Teresa?
Right, because they have to reconcile. Chamber has to pass a bill, and then they have to reconcile it. And the you know, the Senate bill is, I'm sure, crafted keeping in mind who is up for election in the coming year. And they've admitted they're donors. I mean, at least two, maybe three senators have said, you know, this is important to their donors. And also the third factor in this is the Senate rules, where they have to keep the deficit under a certain amount. That's why the proposed
$1.5 trillion,
whatever it is.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham was the latest Republican to say that this GOP tax plan is all about keeping financial contributions of their donors flowing.
Was that a pro for him, or was he saying that's good, or was he saying that's bad, or just
matter of fact,
that's the way it is?
I mean, for politicians, it's great. For everybody else, it's not.
That's why Collins in Western New York has said he's got to keep his donors happy. I heard an interesting interview.
Let's repeat that because it is so stunning.
So
Congressman Collins,
an elected Republican in the Buffalo area, said that he needs to deliver this for his campaign donors, that they're calling him and saying they're not getting their, I guess, their return on investment. I was listening to an interview by Wilf Blitzer in the Situation Room, which I actually think should be renamed the Panic Room. And he was interviewing Mark.
I so agree with you. Breaking news, breaking news. Oh, my God, the world is ending.
Well, they're doing it because they think it works.
Well, I don't. I think it's because Wolf's a little touched.
Yeah, it's a little overdone. But they were interviewing Mark Short, the congressional liaison out of the White House, and he said this is the biggest tax cut in history. And Wolf, to his credit, jumped in and said, No. There are seven other deeper tax cuts in history. This is the biggest corporate tax cut in history. And that's what Aaron and I were talking about. And I think we need to message this the right way. This is corporate tax cuts, not tax cuts.
So that is the question. If you take 100% of the American people, 50% of whom who are citizens don't vote, and ask them when they pass by your door, what's in the tax package, how many people will know? And then you might want to say to them, well, is what's there good or bad? They might say to you, oh, it's bad, or, you know, but they won't be able to tell you what the differences between the Senate and the House bills are.
But even if they can't tell the difference between, like, which deductions are staying, which ones are, you know, going, the bottom line of this, at least for the personal side, and that's what, you know, Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin and every politician is, this is a tax cut for middle-class families. Well, the Tax Policy Center came out so the more details come to light, the more analysis is being done. Mm-hmm. So the Tax Policy Center, which is kind of the go-to, they're reasonably nonpartisan. So the middle-class families will see an increase in their income of about $800, which is 1.5% increase in their income after this tax cut.
Well, a lot of people take that $800 and they'll say thank you for that.
Yeah. But
healthcare, education, property tax,
right? So when you look at the top 1%, so you're looking at really millionaires and above, their after tax income is only going to increase by 2.5%. If you look at the top 0.1%, which is now the multimillionaires, their after tax income will increase 10%. So this is barely a personal tax cut to begin with. You're talking about really small increases over a decade. And by 2027, when this starts to phase out, you're going to see more individuals seeing tax increases than tax decreases. Well, this is a gigantic bait and switch. So even if you get these paltry increases at the beginning, they're going to be phased out by a lot of, you know, fine print, so that more people are going to see tax increases over the next
see decreases. But Aaron, my point is, how many people know what you're saying? That's the important thing.
Well, if they're listening to WMC, they know now.
Well, yes. Well, I'll tell you who's listening to WAMC.
Right. Yeah, I know.
It is a messaging challenge because the Republicans keep saying over and over and over again that this is a middle class tax cut and that all people in the middle class are going to get their taxes cut. In fact, the vast majority of the credible analysis says that's not true. Interesting to hear Congressman John Faso being interviewed yesterday on CNN, and he was saying how great that this was for his constituency. But the reporter then said, well, do the math, and X percentage, I can't remember the percentage, 30%, whatever, X percentage of your middle class will actually get a tax increase. And he said, well, not really, because if you take out the fact that these tax cuts are going to expire after 5 years, then it'll be good for them. Well, that's not what the law says. So he's saying if the bill had different provisions, it would be good for them. But it doesn't have it sunsets these tax cuts. They're not telling, just like on health care, they're not telling the truth. And the question is, can they do this quickly enough so that that doesn't break through?
Yeah. I have an Aaron question, Professor.
Okay.
You say millionaires. I've always been interested in when somebody says this is good for millionaires, does that mean people who have $1 million or does that mean people who are making $1 million every year?
Okay, so when you're looking at income only, the definition of somebody in the top 1%, I think, is like $750,000. So just barely, you know, not quite a millionaire.
The poor thing.
So, you know.
But that's not my point. My point is that we're going to be taxing people who make $1 million
as opposed to have $1 million.
So, correct. Yeah. Okay, so that's the difference. So that's income, and then you have wealth, which is the sum of income plus all of your assets.
Right.
And when you look at the details of the tax cut, which includes the corporate tax cut, this tax cut is extremely biased to people who live off of asset income. Stocks, bonds, real estate holdings.
Mm-hmm. Meaning favorable.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, yes. Highly favorable to people whose income primarily derives from assets as opposed to a paycheck. And that's by design.
Real estate?
Yeah. So, you know, our president seems to have some real estate interests. Our president seems to have some children who might benefit from a large pass down of wealth after Trump dies.
And hedge fund folks do quite well in this, right?
Yes.
Like the Mercers, hedge fund folks. Mm-hmm. What a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to donors, and it's not
Teresa,
only going to—
this is called leading the witness.
Yeah. Well, please lead me, because, yeah, there's so much to talk about on this.
and I still want to get to Puerto Rico, and we only have 10 minutes.
So,
okay, go ahead.
Here's the point, is that these tax cuts, if you look historically after Kennedy's tax cuts, Kennedy's two tax cuts, Reagan's two tax cuts, and Bush's two tax cuts— it has not made the economy better. It has not done anything to lower unemployment. It has not done anything to boost wages. It has not done anything to create new jobs. All it does is reshuffle who gets what money. And the aggregate effect of this is that you transfer about $1 trillion a year from low and middle income families to the top 1%. That's the point of the tax plan, period.
What interests me is in the last election, I think there's agreement that it was economic anxiety because the have-nots felt, you know, that we have a growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in this country, and that they felt that their voices—
They were being left behind.
They're left behind and not heard. And in fact, all the analysis shows that this will increase the economic disparity in this country.
Right.
And also, if you pass these cuts and you don't have enough money to pay for them, it's going to explode the deficits. So that means you're going to have program cuts in the next 6 to 10 months. And after that, you're going to come back with program cuts. And I don't think any of this analysis is factoring in the impact of when you cut education benefits deeper or housing or transportation or any of these other things that the government now pays for. Once, and we saw this with the Reagan tax cuts, they then had to come back and do deep program cuts and tax increases.
Right.
Everybody talks about the Reagan tax cuts, but 2 years later, they had to come back and raise taxes and then raise them again and raise them again.
So I have another concern, Aaron, and maybe you can speak to this. It's what our assets are worth. I mean, you know, in other words, when I'm pretty old now, and I remember very well when $1 million meant a lot of money. But $1 million doesn't mean a lot if you're going to pay $20 for breakfast practically anywhere you go.
$1 million is still a lot.
It's a lot.
No,
you know,
it is.
So a lot of this stuff is adjusted for inflation to take account of the rising cost of living. But, you know, when you're talking about the top 1% in terms of asset holdings, you're looking at people who are, you know, minimum $15 million.
But isn't the cost of living, as you say, the rising cost of living, isn't that inflation?
Yeah, but that's what I'm like. All you know, the tax code is about, you know, it can be adjusted for inflation. So yes, $1 million is not what it once was. Now $1 million is about $14 million.
Say that again.
So you know, so if you go back to who the 1% were back in the '60s and the '70s.
Oh, I see. If you had $1 million in the old days, it was a lot of money.
Now you
need
to be
$14 million.
Yeah, okay. Correct.
All right, let's move on and talk about other stuff here real quick. One is the story that we found out yesterday that Puerto Rico, much of Puerto Rico, is once again without power. We were up to, I think, 35% of...
43%.
How much?
2 days ago, 43% of Puerto Ricans had power. There was a power outage yesterday, so they're down to 18%.
On the main transmission line, right? Is that what happened?
In the entire island.
What happened?
So, you know, this was a whitefish operation. The company out of Montana that was hired to do the repairs, something happened to the main line and went down. So, I want to argue that 43%... you know, in 2 months practically after two hurricanes is not good. Mm. And in the Virgin Islands, it's just as bad. The majority of residents of the Virgin Islands still do not have electricity. But in Puerto Rico, it's down from 43% 2 days ago today to 18%. They think they'll get this line up, quote, relatively quickly. But imagine kind of the psychological effect of...
Thank God that's yours, Judith, and not mine.
Sorry. We all rat each other out.
Yeah.
Imagine the psychological effect of finally getting power back and then it's off again. And there are really severe health implications. There's been a number of articles about how many people died in Puerto Rico after the hurricane, and the official government count that they're keeping with is 55 people. However, some reporters have noticed that 472 more people died in Puerto Rico in September 2017 as opposed to September 2016. And I think that's very, very important. And a lot of that is related to the lack of
electricity. Well, we're talking about people on dialysis and things like that.
Yeah. People in nursing homes who don't have power, people on dialysis, people who can't refrigerate, you know, life-saving medicine. So getting the electricity on is crucial. And I continue to be concerned that unless Congress intervenes, FEMA today is planning to put the same old rickety electricity grid back up in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands that existed prior to the storm. So when there are future hurricanes, the same thing is going to happen all over again.
And then also there was an interesting story about so many people of the plans and the infrastructure, if you will, of people leaving the island.
Yeah, many are leaving. I talked when I was in the Virgin Islands, I had a couple really interesting conversations with families. There's this phenomena that I don't think's been reported yet where the dads are staying behind in the Virgin Islands to try to fix their homes if they have a job. Luckily, if they're not in the tourism industry, they keep their job. And the moms and the children are leaving the Virgin Islands and going to New York or Atlanta or Florida. And often they're going to plan to stay until the end of the school year, maybe longer. So you have these divided and separated families, and they can't often even talk on the cell phone because the cell towers are still down. So there's this huge social impact. Sometimes it's not the entire family leaving, it's part of the families.
And what about the workforce, Judith? When all these people leave, you need a workforce to rebuild the grid, to rebuild the homes. What happens when you lose your workforce? They run the government.
Well, they're importing a lot of workers. A lot of the people working on putting the grid back up are not people from the territories. The big job creator in both Puerto Rico and the West Virgin Islands is tourism, and that is gone, essentially, for the next year and probably longer.
How much of that outward migration of workers, because Puerto Rico has been in a 12-year recession, largely because of a Clinton-era change to how bonds are taxed, and I'm not going to get into the details of that, but it forced Puerto Rico to essentially take on more risky debt and cut government services and raise taxes. So you have a 12-year recession where people were already migrating out of Puerto Rico before. This is just exacerbating that, right?
And you're
a long-term
right.
trend is now becoming intensified.
Yeah,
we only have about 10 seconds.
The migration was happening, but not having electricity, for instance, is forcing many, many more people to leave.
We're out of time. I want to thank everybody who wrote in. Thanks, of course, to our wonderful panelists, Teresa Bourgeois, Aaron Bassetti.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Judith Enk, Alan Chartok. We'll see you tomorrow night at the Egg. Congratulations. Be well.
Don't congratulate me till it's over. That's a curse.
I don't mean to curse you, sir. We'll be back with more show after this.